up and put them in their coat pocket, thinking that they were theirs, and we didn't discover that for almost a week later. And that meant that I couldn't leave. I was in Sarnia at the time. I had no way to get my vehicle going. My wife was with me, but her keys were back in Hamilton. And if you remember that weekend, it was the snowstorm of the winter, and everything the other side of Woodstock was completely shut down, so we couldn't even get a ride back to get the keys and come back. We did that on the Sunday, but it was about an 8.5 hour round trip to get that done. So I don't like to stand people up. It was just one of those times where conditions were outside of my control. Thank you for your graciousness. We'll try not to do that again. And my last preliminary comment, a word of apologies. Al mentioned this morning that I'm going to be working out of James, and that was my assignment, but I didn't check my notes until it was a little late and didn't end up having enough time to switch and prep for James. So we're going to do something else this morning. It's still the Lord's word, and the Spirit is still with us, so I am trusting that it will be an encouragement and a challenge to us in some way or another. I have this picture at home that I'm very fond of. It's a picture of four stone males, not stoned males. My last name is Stone, so it's four guys from our family. It's my father, it's myself, my son, Aaron, and my grandson, my oldest grandson, Matthew, who are all in this picture. And this group is hard labor together, so we got the group together in the backyard and snapped off a few shots. As fond as I am of this picture, not everybody in my family loves it as much as I do. In particular, my granddaughter, who couldn't understand why she wasn't invited to be a part of the picture. And it didn't matter, you know, you try to sit her down and explain, this is a shot that we're trying to do of the men, four generations, and we can't do the same with the women because we don't have every generation rep. She just didn't get it. Anyways, we went to take the picture, and because this group's so seldom together, we snapped several shots in my backyard. And in my backyard, there's this tiny little hill going up in the background. And I looked at the pictures afterwards, and I thought, what's that in the bottom right-hand corner? Is that an animal? No. Kind of looks like a hunk of clothing. And I looked closely enough, and I realized it was my granddaughter trying to creep into the picture. I said I took several shots. I looked at the second one. She was climbing partway up the hill to get in a better spot. Looked at the third picture. There she was, turning around as large as life, smiling, because she was just too important, even though she wasn't invited, to be left out of that picture. The sense of self-importance drove her to make sure that she was in that shot. Now, that's something that little kids would be about, right? Too self-important. None of us would struggle with any sense of self-importance, right? That's just kid stuff. I was in France earlier this year, and it was a gathering of about 26, 27 people that represented 18 different countries, and the people that were there were directors of church networks, so they had parallel roles like the one that I'm in. And we're all there kind of doing some peer learning, sharing, swapping ideas with each other. It was just a great, enriching time. But when we got there, there was this open session, and we were introducing ourselves to each other, just kind of this informal time, shaking hands, saying hi, stuff like that. And there was a gentleman there who, during most of his vocational life, was fairly high up in the British government. And he was a civil servant, but fairly high up nonetheless, so a man of notoriety. And I went over and introduced myself, and his first response is, oh, you're Mike Stone. He had heard of me. And it went off from there. He said, you know, I read your newsletter that it comes out, what, three, four times a year? I said, three times a year. He says, I read that all the time. I'm so glad to finally have met you. I thought, oh, he reads my stuff. He must like what I write. And then he followed up with this comment. But he says, I have to admit, I'm a little surprised. You're much smaller than I thought you would be. I got a kick out of that. Simultaneously, within that greeting, he on the one hand, heightened my sense of self-importance, and he diminished my sense of importance just in one little greeting. You see, I think there's something in every one of us that wants the world to slow down, pause just long enough to look in our direction and notice us and notice how great we are. I think it's in us by the time we're 4 years old, the age of my granddaughter, and I think it's still in us by the time we're 53 years old, probably old enough to know better, to let go of that stuff. We like to be recognized. We like to have a sense of importance and significance in this world. It was a great man who said, and I have this quote written down, "I haven't written my own epitaph, and I'm not sure I should. Whatever it is, I hope it will be simple, and that it will point people not to me, but to the one I serve." Anybody know who said that? Somebody said it over here. I'll give the rest of you a hint if you didn't hear that. It's somebody we said goodbye to several months ago. Billy Graham, yeah. Billy Graham is a man whose fame in this present age exceeded most others, most of his peers. He's a man who dined with heads of states. He's a man who was sought after by, I think, roughly half a dozen U.S. presidents, sought him out in times when those presidents needed spiritual counsel. He's a man whose spiritual tenacity and whose unblemished character caused the world to pause just long enough, look in his direction and say, "My, what a great man." But he's also an individual who early in his life of serving God realized that if he was to have any usefulness in the hand of God, if he was to have any impact, missional impact in this world, he would have to learn to check his ego at the door. And if you know the life story of Billy Graham, you know that he's a man under the Spirit's influence who managed to do just that. He took the ego, the I, out of the equation. He left his ego at the door that he might be fully useful in the hands of God. A man who had great missional impact in the day and age in which he lived. The text I want us to look at this morning is a text that's embedded in a larger passage that's all about mission. We're going to look at Luke chapter 9, and I'm going to pick up at about verse 46. You don't have to turn there quite yet, but 46 down to about 56. And the reason I know that the larger section is about mission, and the passage that we're going to look at is about mission, is because of the bookends that surround this passage. The larger passage begins with Luke chapter 9, the opening verses, and there we find Jesus sending out the 12. The second bookend, the back bookend of this larger second, is the opening verses of Luke chapter 10, where Jesus sends out the 70 or the 72. It's a textual variant. You can read whatever number you want there. The sending out should be a hint that it's partially about mission. Now, these numbers, well, they're real numbers. I actually think there was a group of 12, and then later I think there was a group of 70 or 72. These numbers are also symbolic in significance. You see, the 12 that are first sent out correspond to the 12 tribes of Israel in the Old Testament. And the 70 or the 72 disciples that are sent out later, that corresponds to the elders that served under the direction of Moses in the Old Testament. I think what Jesus is doing here in sending both of these groups out, and Luke in the way that he's organizing the telling of the story, I think Jesus is reconstituting the people of God. I think he's gathering the New Testament people of God, and he's launching them into the very thing that they've been called into being for, which is mission. And we know that because in both cases, when he sends out the 12 and then he sends out the 70, he tells them to do exactly the same thing. He sends them out empty-handed. He says to enter the home of the other. He says, when you go in there, I want you to do two things. I want you to heal the sick, and I want you to announce that the kingdom has drawn near. I want you to embody the good news, and I want you to announce the good news. Friends, that's mission. That's what the church has always been about. And when the church is not engaged in its missional calling, it ceases to be the community that God called her to be in the first place. And in the section that I'm going to read for you, there are three little vignettes, three little mini stories. And in each one of these, I think we hear a warning from the Spirit of God. The warning is this: if you want to go on mission with Jesus, you better learn to check your ego at the door. If you want to go on mission with Jesus, you better learn to get over yourself, because it's not about you. Let me read this passage together. Luke chapter 9, verses 46 down to 56. Three little vignettes. An argument started among the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. We hear the theme right away. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. Then he said to them, "Whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. For it is the one who is least among you who is, or among you all, who is the greatest." Verse 49, "Master," said John, "we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him, because he's not one of us." "Don't stop him," Jesus said. For whoever is not against you is for you. Verse 51. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And he sent messengers on ahead who went into the Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. When the disciples, James and John, saw this, they asked, "Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to destroy them?" But Jesus turned and rebuked them. Then he and his disciples went to another village. Three little mini stories. And each one, I think we hear this warning or this invitation to get over yourself, to check the ego at the door, that we might be useful in the hands of God in this world, that we might have missional impact. This first little story, we read that an argument broke out amongst the disciples. We're not sure why completely they started arguing about who was the greatest. It might have something to do with the fact that three of the 12 were just up on the mountain with Jesus and saw his transfiguration. They witnessed Jesus transform before their very eyes, the whitest white you could see, the brightest brightness you could see, and there, in all his glory, he was flanked on either side by these two greats of the Old Testament, Moses and Elijah, but it was clear they were the lesser and he was the greatest in their midst. What they were given in this case was a preview of Jesus post-resurrected, post-ascended glory. And I think seeing Jesus in all his greatness, perhaps these three come down from the mountain, are with the rest of the disciples, and they start to think about their own grandeur and their own greatness. Whatever it was that caused them to start thinking about this, Jesus interrupts the conversation. He takes a little child and he walks into their midst, and you can almost hear Jesus clearing his throat. Excuse me, guys. Draws their attention to this child, and he says, "Whoever welcomes this little child welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me." And then he goes on from there to say, "Whoever is least among you is in fact the one who is the greatest." Now, it's not immediately apparent what Jesus is doing with this object lesson of this child, at least not in the day and age in which we live in. We live in a culture that places a high value on children. In fact, sometimes maybe a little too much. We can get a little too child-centric in the society that we live in. But it wasn't like that in the first century Rome. In ancient Rome, children were considered to have no intrinsic value. It's almost like they were statusless beings. They weren't important at all. So I think what Jesus is doing here with this object lesson, as he drags his child, or not drags, places this child in front of them, he's saying to them, listen, if you want to be truly great, if you're really interested in being a great person in this world, don't try to pursue and align your life with those the world considers the greatest, those that the world considers most important. Instead, chase after, align your life with, learn to serve those who are the least and the lonely in this world, those who have no great status, who aren't considered important. Align your lives, learn to serve those who can do nothing for you. They can't help improve your brand in any ways. Those are the ones. That's the way to pursue true greatness in this life. And that's something you don't often see in our world. You see most people trying to be great by pursuing and hanging out with the great people. And when you see the alternative, it stands out like a diamond against a black cloth because it's so rare. I love the story of Mother Teresa, who received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1979 for her work amongst the poor who lived on the streets of Calcutta. And when she landed in Oslo to receive her award, the tarmacs were completely full of snow, and the officials there looked at what she was wearing and realized she wasn't appropriately dressed for the occasion. She didn't have a coat, all she had was sandals, and so they went and they got a fur coat for her to put on so she'd be warm, and they got some boots for her, and the story as it goes says she put up her hand and said, "Nope, I don't want a coat, I don't want the boots." She said, I made a vow years ago to live my life in solidarity with the poor. The poor have no coat. The poor have no boots. I don't need them either. Now, I think they tussled with her and kept arguing and eventually made her put some socks or something on her feet to make sure she didn't freeze. But the point is, she would rather live her life in solidarity with the poor. Went on from there She found out, too, that 3,000 pounds had been set aside for a banquet to be held in her honor. She received this award. That's roughly equivalent, friends, to about $25,000 in today's money, Canadian. She found that out and she said, I don't want the banquet. Take that money and give it to the poor. They deserve that money far more than I do. They continued to have the award ceremony, even though they canceled the banquet at her request. And award ceremonies, when you get something like the Nobel Peace Prize, the best thing to do is to get up there, smile, nod, shake a couple hands, receive your award graciously, and get down. That's not Mother Teresa's style. You see, they had just liberalized the laws in that country regarding the rights of unborn children, regarding abortion. And she saw this as an opportunity to challenge people. So she stepped in that spot, and as she got her award, she called out the leaders and the influencers in the room and called them to use their powers and their authority and their influence to protect those who can't speak for herself. Yikes. Some of us would be too concerned about stepping on toes in a situation like that. Perhaps the best part, the favorite part of the story for me, is hearing that when she left the event, she forgot her Nobel Peace Prize. She left it in the coat closet, the coat check of all places. The award mattered little, so little to her that, you know, if it was you or me, I don't know about you, I shouldn't speak for you. For me, I'd be clutching onto this thing. Look what I got. She leaves it, forgets it in the coat closet. But then, as the story continues, said when she arrived home, there was a little child from her village that came up to her and said, Mama, I heard that you were given a great honor. And she said, yes, that is true. He said, I don't have, this is just a little child. He says, I don't have very much, but I want to give you something. Here's my reward for you. And gave her a little bowl of dry rice. Not all that prestigious. But it says in the story that she took that bowl and she placed it on her nightstand where it remained for a long, long time. I love the juxtaposition of those two images. The forgotten Nobel Peace Prize in the closet, and the little bowl of rice from a poor child. What mattered most to Mother Teresa? Notoriety? Fame? Being important in the world's eyes? Or aligning her life with the least and lonely and the powerless? It's a rhetorical question because you know the answer. In the second little vignette or story here, we encounter the disciples who run across this man who's casting out demons in Jesus' name, but they tell him to stop. They forbid him to keep doing it because he's not a part of their group. He wasn't numbered amongst them. Jesus hears that they're trying to stop, and he says, don't do that. Whoever is not against you is for you. Now, as an aside, I love this little section because it reminds me, if you see the disciples in this case as the believing community, it's a reminder to me that the kingdom of God is always bigger than the church. God's work in the world always transcends the church. As much as the church might be the servant or the instrument of God's kingdom, God is doing stuff beyond the barriers and the walls of the church amongst people that sometimes we go, really, God? You're working through them? They're not a part of us. That's the way God rules. He uses whoever he wants to get his stuff done in the world. Well, what's going on in this passage here? If you go back to verses 37 and 40, what we find is the disciples who are trying to stop this man earlier have an opportunity to cast out a demon of their own. They encounter this man who's got a child who's gripped by a demon. This demon is causing seizures and causing the kid to scream. The disciples try to cast the demon out, but they flounder and they flub it, and they can't manage to do it. They fail. And basically, Jesus has to come along, step into the situation, and do for them what they couldn't do for themselves. Here these disciples find themselves, just a few verses later, encountering a man who is able to do. He was successful at doing the very thing that they couldn't do. And I think they felt threatened by this man's success. And I think their insecurity gave way to envy. And I think their envy compelled them to villainize this guy and to discredit the good, the very legitimate kingdom things that he was doing. Because he was making them feel just a little insecure. I wonder at times if we end up struggling with the same thing. We look at how God is using other people and the splash that they're having for the kingdom's sake, And we get just a little insecure, and we start to feel envious. Maybe it's just me. I pastored a church. I've pastored in three different church settings. I pastored a church for 20 years on the other end of the GTA. And during the 20 years there, lots of other churches spring up. I should say about the fellowship that we were involved in. We saw the Lord's blessing, people coming to faith, the congregation growing. But there were some other churches in town that were taking off like gangbusters. The first decade I was pastoring this church setting, there was another church across town that became very well known. Lovely staff. I love the people there. I love the leaders there. We were doing this. They all of a sudden like started to soar, this other church, and everybody knew about them and wanted to come to this church, and they were growing like gangbusters. The second decade I was serving in this church over in Oakville now, another church sprouted up. And they started much later than us, but they passed us and transcended us in terms of splash and visibility and numerical size and a lot of the things that people look to as indicators of health. Those aren't the only indicators, but they were having a big impact in the community. Now, I'm smart enough to know and wise enough to know that the last thing you want to do is to speak negative about other people that are doing well, because it starts to look like sour grapes after a while. And I genuinely love the other people at this church. They're great people at these other two fellowships. And so publicly, I made sure that I was always praising and endorsing and affirming that. But if I'm honest, deep down inside, there was a little bit of insecurity in my own life. And I found myself having a conversation, not with others, because I didn't want to discredit them, had this internal conversation going on in my head about, well, you know what, they're not using the right methodology. Sure, they're getting it done, but they're not going about it the right way. Or they don't have the right values. They're not honoring the proper core values that you should have as a congregation. What I was doing is having this conversation with myself subconsciously to make myself feel a little better about the fact that they were having a bigger impact than we were. I don't know about you, but I think sometimes I can easily find myself looking at how God is blessing another fellowship across town. And I wonder how many other churches there might be in this area that as you look over your own shoulder, you see the Lord's blessing on them, you wonder why maybe it's not happening here to the same degree, and you can find yourself subtly, insidiously starting to speak negatively about that other fellowship. Where is that coming from? Or let's not even look outside the fellowship. Let's look across the room here. Is there somebody else on the other side of the room that's known as a better Bible study leader than you are? And that's something you always wanted to be. Or somebody who's known in this fellowship as being very compassionate, has a listening ear, and everybody goes to them when they're looking for spiritual counsel. And you want to be that person in this fellowship. Or you're known as the most hospitable person in this fellowship because you always open your home and people feel at ease there and they love to come to your place. And there's somebody else across the room who's always wanted to be that person. And you can find yourself, if you're not careful, in your own head, because you know not to do it publicly, discrediting what that person has been doing, because the blessing that's on them makes you feel just a little insecure. Friends, if the 12 disciples were susceptible to this, every single one of us here aren't. It's a good reminder to ask, Spirit of God, what's going on in my heart right now? Last little vignette, verse 51 to 56. We find the disciples traveling down from Galilee in the north to Jerusalem in the south, and they do so by cutting through the land of Samaria. And as they go through, Jesus wants to stop in the village, so he sends some of his disciples ahead to make preparation, only to find out when the disciples get there, the Samaritans in that village don't want them. Take off, go away, you're not welcome here. So what's going on behind that? Well, for the long time, there had been bad blood between the Jews and the Samaritans. Jews looked down their nose at the Samaritan people. They didn't use the right scriptures. They were kind of a mixed race, a group of half-breeds. And they didn't worship in the proper place. Every good, faithful, upstanding Jew knew that the proper place to worship was in Jerusalem. The Samaritans had set up their own altar up on Mount Gerizim. And there, that's where they worship God. And so there's a little bit of bad blood between these two groups. And I think as you listen to this story, we discover a twofold offense that's taking place. I think on the one hand, the Samaritans are offended that they're not seen by this group of Jews, or any Jews in general. This is just the representative group now. They are not seen as a spiritually legitimate people. They know that their way of life isn't respected by the Jews, but it's okay for you to cut through our land. It's okay for you to take a shortcut through here to get to Jerusalem. Well, thanks, but no thanks. You can take the long way around unless you give us a little more esteem as a legitimately spiritually legitimate people. But I think on the other hand, this group of Jesus' disciples are also a little offended. They're coming into town and they're bringing with them Jesus. They're bringing with them the one who's caused the kingdom to draw near. They're coming into town to teach, to announce good news, to perform miracles, to heal the sick, to cast out demons. They're coming to serve this village. And you don't want us here? Well, fine then. So I think there's a little both-way offense that's taking place here. And we read as you go on in the story that two of the disciples, James and John, who, by the way, anybody remember the nickname of James and John, sons of Zebedee? Do you know what that means? Sons of Thunder. Okay, so keep that in mind. It's the sons of thunder, James and John, that turn to Jesus and basically say, my paraphrase here, Jesus, do you want us to torch this place? Do you want us to call down fires from the heavens and have this whole village kind of licked up or flattened? Now, if you read the Gospels enough, you know that Jesus is not the type of person to turn around and say, go ahead, light them up, boys. That's not Jesus' style. He loves people too much. But in this case, you wonder if Jesus perhaps would turn to the Samaritans and say, listen, guys, and gently kind of redirect them. Listen, guys, we're coming to town to do some good here. Just open your homes. We're coming to announce the kingdom. We're going to heal. We're going to cast out demons. But it says that he doesn't rebuke the Samaritans. He rebukes his own boys. We're not told what he said. But we know it must have been firm because it was subject over, conversation over. They stopped and they went on their merry way. Now, what's going on here? I think the disciples were eager in this case to strike back at the Samaritans because they were offended at what? Being rejected. Being rejected. How often does our own fear of rejection keep us from participating in conversations about Jesus in the broader culture? How often does our concern about not being fully embraced or welcomed keep us from initiating conversations about the good news that God loves all people through Jesus and what he's accomplished on the cross? Sometimes I wonder if we are too thin-skinned to be any good for the kingdom, to have any impact in this world. I wonder if at times we care too much about being accepted, about being welcomed, about being fully embraced. And when you boil it down, in the end, maybe our problem is a form of spiritual narcissism. We love ourselves and are more concerned about ourselves than we are concerned about the very people that God has called us to. We don't love them enough. If we love them, we'd be willing to set that risk of rejection aside in order to speak the good news to them. I had a chance when I was in France back in February to hear a gentleman by the name of Isaac Shaw speak. Isaac is the director of Delhi Bible Institute in India. And through his school, they shape the lives and train young adults to go out, in, mostly into India, but into Southeast Asia, to share the good news. And often they get sent into the northern parts of India where it is very difficult. It's legal to be a Christian in India, but in the northern parts of India, people take matters into their own hand. And there's a lot of persecution against followers of Jesus and against the church. Isaac says, it does a number on you when you send out a missions team of students from your school to get a phone call a few days later and somebody from the team says, help, we don't know what to do. Our leader has been killed. We're afraid and we're coming home. And in that moment to feel the Spirit of God to nudge him to say, no, don't come home. I will come to you. And then for him to go home, he says, it does a number on you to pack your bag, say goodbye to your kids, goodbye to your wife, and go join that group of students knowing that it might be the very last time you see your family. He has had colleagues and students killed for their faith. He himself has spent nights in prison, held unlawfully because of his faith. He has been held down by a group of people, and while some have held him on either side, others have started kicking him and beating him up. He says he's had a boot kind of kept on his forehead while others have laid a beating into him. He says, in that moment, though, when somebody's boot is on your head, it becomes incredibly clarifying. He says, all the fear that used to paralyze you before, somehow or another, mysteriously, just kind of falls away. It becomes very clarifying in that moment, ultimately, what has the most importance, my own well-being or those that don't know Jesus yet. And he actually says that situations like that can galvanize you, can strengthen you against those that want to persecute you for the gospel's sake. Here's a man who has learned along the way to love others more than being concerned about his own skin. How many people here would love to be incredibly useful in the hands of Jesus? Hold your hands up. How many people here would love to have significant impact in the world for the kingdom? Yeah. If that's something that you long for, you, like I, will need help from the Spirit of God to get over your own sense of fame, your own desire for success, to make the biggest splash for the kingdom for your own namesake, and to set aside any concern you might have about your personal well-being. The I in the equation, the ego, needs to be checked at the door if we're going to be useful in the hands of God. Let me finish with this. I was referencing Mother Teresa a little while ago. Does anybody remember where they were or the circumstances of their life at the time when Mother Teresa passed away? If you remember, raise your hand. I'm not surprised. She passed away in 1997 in September, I think September 5th, yeah, right about there. So this past fall, we commemorated 20 years since this wonderful woman, somebody who'd been super useful for God, left this age and passed into the age to come. And she passed away 5 days after Princess Diana. And that's why I'm not surprised that any of us, that we have a problem remembering, because most of us at the time were probably caught up with the story of Princess Diana's life. And as I think about the ending of the lives of these two people, and I don't mean to diminish one over the other, but Princess Diana was a celebrity in the world sense of a celebrity. Not that she didn't do good for the world, but when she passed away, it was like a black hole that grabbed the whole world's attention, turned all the heads towards her. And Mother Teresa at the time is barely even noticed. And I remember thinking at that time how unfair this was. This woman who had given everything and had made a significant impact in a way that Princess Diana hadn't was being completely ignored. And then it dawned on me, this is exactly the way that Mother Teresa would have wanted it. Here I am upset, but it wouldn't have bothered her the least. In fact, she would have preferred it, to have the attention on others and for her to slide from this present age into eternity without anybody applauding or noticing, because she didn't care about that stuff. It didn't matter to her at all. She just cared about the well-being of others. It's a tough life to live without the Spirit of God helping us. So as I wrap up here, let me pray for myself, and I will pray for you as well. Father, in some ways, an obscure little passage in the middle of Luke, and I remember first reading this section, God, and just glossing over it and wondering what of significance was there. Thank you for drawing my own attention to this need to let go of my own sense of importance or fame or success, or concerned about whether or not people really want me in their group or that I'm fully embraced. God, this isn't something that we can check once in our life and be done with it once and for all. It has this lure, this temptation has a way of raising its ugly head over our lives. We are thin-skinned, sensitive people, and we want to be somebody. Oh God, would you forgive us, first of all? Would you be merciful towards us for all those times that we've been more concerned about ourselves and who we are in this world than we've been concerned about the things that are near and dear to your heart. the least and the lonely. And God, would you give us the courage, even as we leave this place, as we can step into the world, our places where we live, our neighborhoods, our work, places that we learn and play, as we step into those places and are tempted once again to put self first over the well-being of others and what you'd have us do in their lives, God, would you give us the courage to resist, to set self aside, and to lift those people up for the kingdom's sake. We need your reminder, Spirit of God. We need your courage. We need our hearts broken again. We need to become a compassionate people. Oh God, by your Spirit, would you help us for our own sake, for the well-being of those that you are connecting us to, and for the well-being of the world, so that you get the honor and glory, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.